Welcome to the Myopia Exchange. It's our new podcast series where we'll be talking all things myopia from research to practice. So each Myopia Exchange will be about 15 minutes long and full of nerdy goodness, and I will attempt to be launching them weekly. And for our inaugural podcast, I'd like to welcome James Lockman, who's a Professor of Optometry and Vision Science from the Technological University in Dublin in Ireland. James is also director of the Centre for Eye Research Ireland, or CERI, whose group presented several research papers at the recent International Myopia Conference in Tokyo. So, James, thank you so much for joining us on this first podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kate. I'll try to be at my nerdy best.
Oh, look, I'm sure we're going to have no problems talking nerd for 15 minutes. I think that'll be an easy ask, much easier than all the technology, for sure. Since I just mentioned it, could you give us a little quick rundown on CERI's current myopia research, the work that you guys are doing?
Sure. Yeah, we've a pretty extensive profile of research in general. It extends beyond myopia. We're doing some work in diabetes and glaucoma and things like that. But myopia is certainly the core of our work. So currently we're focused around three clinical trials, two of which involving atropine, one which is exploring just 0.01% atropine, which is the MOSAIC study. Mm-hmm. The other is exploring two concentrations, 0.01 and 0.02%. That's a multi-centered clinical trial called the CHAMP study. Early next year, we've just signed off on contracts. So we'll be launching a contact lens-based study. So that'll be good, kind of just to vary things up a little bit. Lots of other priorities beyond the clinical trials. There's 13 postgraduate students here all working on their PhDs and so on. And they're looking at various aspects, including nutritional components. Big data is a really kind of dynamic area now, and it's something that we're very much involved in and trying to push on. And myopia is again at the forefront of that. So lots of different things going on.
Fantastic! It's a hive of activity. So what we wanted to talk about today, what you and I have discussed talking about, an absolute hot topic right now in myopia research and absolutely in practice as well, is atropine, and particularly low-dose atropine, 0.01%. So your take on the current state of play is that atropine 0.01% has got a bit of a bad rap. And it's been cast as the bad guy. And you've got a bit of a different view on this. And I know that we've had a little bit of a conversation about the ATOM 1 and ATOM 2 study populations and techniques, the LAMP study, how we sort of interpret this in terms of clinical practice. So tell us a little bit about why you think we need to give 0.01% atropine another look, or why we shouldn't be throwing it in the bin at this point in time.
I suppose I've two different kind of perspectives on this and kind of coming at it from slightly different angles. And one is that, you know, following ATOM 2, there was a big rush to get into 0.01%, which was, you know, in some sense, very understandable and logical. You know, this tiny dose, which had a really good side effect profile compared to the standard therapy, you know, seemed to have a really good controlling effect. So there was a logical move in that direction. I think, however, it was a bit premature to a certain extent. Understandable, but not quite justified. But on the opposite side of that, on the flip side now, I think that, you know, more and more, every conference I go to, there's more and more papers which are really kind of dismissing 0.01% and saying that it's now not really a runner and that we should be pushing a slightly higher dose. And I think that's equally premature. I just don't think the data is there to support a definitive conclusion either way on 0.01%. So I don't really have a strong opinion in either direction. I'm kind of my opinion is that we really should be just waiting for the evidence. There's about 30 trials ongoing out there, and many of those involve 0.01%. So, you know, they have the capacity. We don't have data outside of Asia. Another thing, and you can't really extrapolate findings from Singapore to a European population or an Australian population. And even actually, you know, we mentioned kind of the ATOM and LAMP studies. And I actually think that fundamentally, we actually don't have good data out of Asia itself. Both those studies, I think, have kind of flaws or certainly concerns that would, I suppose, alter the interpretation to a certain extent.
And so obviously one of the flaws, if we're talking about that in terms of the ADAM2 study, the ADAM2 two-year and the ADAM2 five-year study, from which the favour for 0.01% atropine grew, obviously the main criticism of that is we didn't have a control group the whole way through that study.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this the attempt to try and compare ADAM2 to that historic control group in ADAM1, I think it's just kind of fundamentally flawed and just in an unquantifiable way. So, like, if we could exactly predict kind of what the variation would, what effect that might have had, then I think we could draw some conclusions. But, you know, there's some basic difference. One critical one is that axial length was measured using different techniques across the two trials. Not even just two different tests. It wasn't an IOL master and Aladdin or some other kind of biometer. It was biometry using optical versus ultrasound techniques. An ultrasound is much less, I suppose, repeatable as a measurement compared to IOL biometry. So that's kind of thing. You know, the ADAM1 kids were younger than the ADAM2 kids. Kind of other variations between the two studies that have been documented in numerous papers. And I just don't think that those differences are quantifiable.
That they're quite comparable. So the ADAM1 children being younger means as a control group, they'd be more likely to progress than when compared to ADAM2. Yeah.
Exactly. Younger eyes will grow quicker. So we know that.
Yeah. And which of those two studies had the better equipment for measuring axial length? So you said one was ultrasound.
Well, ADAM1 used ultrasound and ADAM2 used the IOL master.
Okay. So we could be jumping to conclusions in trying to compare ADAM1 and ADAM2. But what about the LAMP study? So we have 1 year data from the LAMP study where a control group in comparison to the 0.01% showed something like 12%, only 12% control of axial elongation with the 0.01%. What about the LAMP study?
Well, I suppose on that first point that there's only 1 year placebo, that's an issue. Noel Brennan actually made a really interesting comment in a paper he published recently where he was kind of busting some myths that are out there about myopia. And one of the really interesting points he made, and I agree with it totally, is that we shouldn't really be drawing any strong conclusions from 1 year data on any study. And I think that's valid. I think, you know, the longer we have the 2 and 3 year data, the ADAM2 study kind of shows certainly that the effects of low dose atropine can vary over time. I don't think that is the major kind of concern though for me anyway with LAMP. I kind of would have serious reservations and a question mark about the biological impact of the 0.01% concentration used in the LAMP study. So that's not something we've actually discussed before. And it's not something that's really brought up all that much. Like the authors do raise it a little bit in the paper and they try and explain it away, but they don't really get into it in a way that, or certainly they don't interpret their data in relation to that. But if you look at the ADAM2 study and you look at the LAMP study side by side, and you know, you're always a bit cautious in terms of comparing two different studies and two different groups, but both use 0.01%. Now, we know what atropine does to the eye. It has the side effect profile involves effects on accommodation and effects on pupil size.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So ADAM2 had a pretty substantial effect on both. So, you know, accommodation decreased by about 4 diopters within the first 2 weeks of 0.01% atropine use in ADAM2. And maintained at that level then for the remainder of the study. In LAMP, there was no response to accommodation. There was no effect. There was a quarter of a diopter change in response to using 0.01% atropine. And in fact, if you look at the placebo group, they actually had a slightly larger change. They lost 0.32 diopters of accommodation.
The placebo affected accommodation more than 0.01%.
Yeah, not statistically, but just in terms of the raw in terms of the raw numbers. So, like the authors, they reported kind of that there was a dose dependent effect impact on accommodation, but that's really only comparing say 0.05% to the lower concentrations. But basically, there was no impact on accommodation from the 0.01% concentration, which you know that's that's a problem, you know, in my eyes. Kind of if it's not affecting anterior eye function, then, you know, how are we going to expect it to have an impact more distally, if you like? Pupils was the same. The magnitude of difference was not quite as bad, but the ATOM2 had a between 2 and 4 times higher effect or greater effect on pupil size than the LAMP study at the 0.01% concentration.
0.01%. So that's really fascinating, and I think that's something that we might presume that 0.01% equals 0.01% equals 0.01%. Exactly. You know, it's all the same, and we can trust that a contact lens of the same design is going to be repeatable. But that's something I've learned a little bit about recently, is how unstable atropine is as a chemical, especially when it's being compounded. So how much, this sort of feeds into what you've just said, how much do you think this could be to blame for the apparent poor results in recent studies? And what are these, you know, you said there's 30 studies going on around the world right now. So what else do we still need to know about atropine itself as a chemical to trust that we're actually getting consistent dosage?
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot. We've known for a long time that atropine is inherently unstable, but as a concept, it's kind of underappreciated. It's affected by lots of factors, kind of, you know, light exposure, pH, you know, how airtight is the container it's in, temperature it's stored at, what plastic is in the container, even all those things can impact how stable the product is going to be. And I think your point is exactly right. Kind of 0.01%, you know, certainly if you look at 0.01% in LAMP versus 0.01% in ATOM2, they seem two fundamentally different products with fundamentally different biological effects on the eye. Mm. So that, you know, that really kind of calls that into question, kind of, that we need to know much, much more about the product that we're using. And if we're going to use compounded atropine, we should be asking some serious questions of whoever's providing it.
Yeah. So, okay. And so does that mean with newer atropine studies, we should expect some reporting on, you know, is it within the scope of a study to have to report the pH or the stability or the repeatability of the treatment itself?
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In preparing for our Mosaic study, we were working for about 2 years on trying to get the right study formulation. And we had a really clear idea of what we wanted, which was something which was, you know, single dose, preservative free. We would view that as a better way of treating children for an extended period. pH as close to neutral as possible. We were working with one company for over a year just trying to get a stable formulation with those characteristics, and we couldn't do it.
Oh, wow.
We couldn't get it. So this is a well-known, well-established international company with a long history in producing eye drop formulations, and they couldn't actually achieve it. Ultimately, we did get that, and the formulation we're using in Mosaic and in CHAMP is single dose and preservative free. pH is 7. It's got stability data for up to 18 months now at this stage. These are important considerations. These have gone through regulatory bodies who've assessed the evidence that are being provided and said, this says what it is, what it is, basically.
So we know the kids are getting that what your treatment is being consistently delivered. This is making me think about, for example, as an analogy, multifocal contact lenses. Not all multifocal contact lenses are created equal in terms of design of the lens. And as we're starting to understand, they're probably not all created equal in terms of efficacy. And so we wouldn't say any multifocal is equivalent to any other multifocal as we learn more about this with time. And it's sounding to me a little bit like 0.01% atropine. We can't assume that we're getting the same thing each time and we're getting what's being used in a study unless we also ask those questions about the formulation itself and about its stability.
I think all those, you know, any practitioner who's doing this, I think they really should ask serious questions of who's making the atropine. You know, what is its pH? What preservatives are being used? How stable is it? Do they have data kind of illustrating the stability of it? All those things, I think those questions are actually probably more important than what dose is right at the moment.
And do you think our poor old compounding pharmacist up the road can answer that question for us?
Possibly
That's
not.
Problem?
Yeah.
Does that speak to us just really needing a commercial formulation.
I think so, yeah. You know, I think we need to have a product that's evidence-based, not just a concept that 0.01% or 0.02% or 0.05%. I think we need to know that product itself has established efficacy, safety profile, and so on before we really start to roll this out.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a very different way of thinking about it, I think, compared to what we have presumed. We presume a medication is always the same, but we don't presume an optical product is necessarily that they're all created equal. So that's really interesting. Mm. Mm-hmm. So can I ask you about a clinical case? In terms of talking about side effects, you were talking about if we don't see a small mydriatic or cycloplegic effect, then we have to wonder if it has biological activity or not. So in terms of side effects, I just recently saw a 12-year-old and she was referred to me for atropine treatment. And it's because she'd refused contact lens options with her referring optometrist. So when she presented to me and I took her history, she and her mother explained to me that she'd just started taking an SSRI antidepressant, and, you know, we traditionally think of that as a contraindication or it's going to potentiate the pupil dilation and cycloplegic effects of an anticholinergic medication. So for me, that became a red flag for atropine. And I thought, okay, well, I'm probably going to take atropine off the table for this child. And in the end, she was 12 and I talked around to wearing contact lenses and she's going well with those. So do you think in terms of side effects and particularly systemic side effects that was an overreaction for that particular patient? Do you think, how concerned should we be about systemic side effects?
I think we have to be concerned about them. I don't think it was an overreaction at all. I think you're absolutely right. Maybe not for the reason that you might think, kind of in that, you know, the use of 0.01% atropine is either off label or it's got no label in that it's completely unlicensed. So I think outside of the confines of a clinical trial, I think administering 0.01% or any concentration of atropine to someone on another licensed medication is probably putting you, the practitioner, at risk. I think that's one thing that we need to consider. You know, I really think that atropine belongs in kind of regulatory approved trials with clear guidelines for use with coexisting medicines or conditions, and that isn't out there at the moment. So again, that's one of the other questions that needs to be addressed is, you know, all the clinical trials have certain inclusion exclusion criteria. They will include certain medical conditions and so on. But I think 0.01% atropine has been adopted in clinical practice without that, you know, a real consideration of how it should be used alongside other medicines in the case of certain medical conditions. So I do think that needs to be clarified and prioritized before we do get into that.
That's interesting. So we're talking about really changing our thinking around atropine. And what I guess I'm hearing from you is we shouldn't write it off, but we also don't quite know what we're getting at the moment when we're compounding it.
We don't. Like, I mean, I just don't, from a purely just a logical or a common sense perspective, I don't know how you can achieve 59% control, for example, in the ADAM2 study on refractive error progression. Or there's several other studies, you know, there's a lot of retrospective evidence, even in Europe, kind of there's two or three studies from Italy and other regions, Germany recently, which have shown efficacy in relation to refractive error progression. There's a clinical trial, a five-year clinical trial out of Spain, which is shown again that 0.01% is effective in terms of controlling refractive error. Fundamentally, I don't believe that we can achieve that level of refractive error progression control without having an axial length, an axial growth impact. Most myopia in young kids and even young adults, it's axial in nature. You know, one of the things that actually came out recently in kind of some of the postings on myopia profile was that I think there's an underappreciation of the difference between what's normal eye growth versus what's abnormal or myopic eye growth. And that, I think that's another thing that we need to consider, that if you're using atropine at any concentration, just getting into our heads that we're actually not trying to stop eye growth. We're trying to stop the myopic component of that. So, you know, if you were to examine, you know, a bunch of emmetropes, 10-year-old, 11-year-old emmetropes, and follow them over time, what you would expect to see is that, you know, the refraction is not changing, it's stable, but there is some eye growth still. That's just normal eye growth. And you know, it's matched with, you know, the growth and refractive and optical elements, they match each other. So the child doesn't change in terms of their refractive error status. And that's a component that we need to deal with in clinical practice, in that if you put someone on 0.01% or 0.05% atropine and you bring them back every few months or whatever, you probably should expect to see some eye growth. We're not expecting it to stop normal eye growth. We've been working on effectively developing a centile calculator, which is designed to effectively plot a child's you know, biometric characteristics, whether that's their refractive error or their axial length or ALCR or whatever parameter we choose, and just plotting that against where they are relative to the normal population, if you like. And you know, that's not something that can be achieved by looking at control data in clinical trials. It needs kind of large population-based studies that have measured refractive error, have measured axial length and other characteristics. So that's what we've been doing, basically, is sourcing data from Europe, looking at sources also from the US and Asia, to effectively just build this calculator, which can provide a really useful clinical tool, whereby a practitioner can just plot the information, for example, just axial length, plug in the axial length with that child's age and ethnicity and other parameters, and see where they are in a centile chart. So you know if a child is in the 80th to 90th centile or higher, if they're not already myopic, you know, we know in some of the analysis that we've already done on this, we know they're at high risk of becoming short-sighted within a relatively short period of time. So if we can use that during the course of treatment, what we would want to see is that if you start treating somebody with atropine or a contact lens or whatever it might be, that centile position will change. And that's the key that we're looking for, so that we know that even if there is some normal growth, it's within the normal, you know, pattern of growth you would expect, but we've got rid of the abnormal kind of the escalated growth pattern, so that the child's centile position has stabilized or starts to come down. That's back really towards the average level. So I think that will be a really useful clinical tool, because it's something we don't really have right now. And that will be a challenge if we're going to incorporate axial length into our clinical practice, which everyone is promoting that we should be doing, and they're absolutely right. We just need to figure out how to do that in a really, really clinical effective manner. And I think that will help with that.
Absolutely. I think that's something that clinicians measuring axial length now be really excited for. And then presumably we have more ways to measure axial length that are more affordable in primary care practice that would incorporate these sorts of centile charts. So that's very exciting stuff for the future. So I guess I think about a few years' time and I think, all right, we might have, you know, reliable, verified low-dose atropine. We're going to have a whole raft of data from new studies. We're going to have more access to these centile charts and to axial length measurements. But what do we do right now? What would you advise that our clinicians do right now about prescribing atropine, about the concentration, and what should they be looking for if they can't measure or if they're not measuring axial length at this point?
Well, I mean, I'd come back to the issue of stability first, and I would start to ask serious questions of the, you know, the compounding pharmacy, and just, you know, at least raise that an issue, flag it as something that's of concerns. As I mentioned earlier, I think that's the stability of the formulation we're treating with is a more important aspect than the actual dose right now. On the basis of the current evidence, I would probably suggest starting with a 0.01% of a stable product if you can get it, as used in ATOM 2, for example. Like, there's clear evidence that the 0.01% used in LAMP is just not biologically effective in the eye. So, and there's a real chance that compounded products may suffer from that same issue. So I would think start with that and go from there. You know, it is a challenge right now. how to interpret the axial length data if we're getting it.
Yeah.
You know, I think if we're achieving effective refractive error control, I think that's good. You know, there's all sorts of, I think it's great. It will be great in time to have the options to use atropine at various doses and possibly even in combination with optical strategies to achieve the greatest possible level of control. But I think we just need a careful, considered approach to how we use atropine in clinical practice now. Because as I said earlier, I think it's premature to get straight into it, but I'm realistic to expect that practitioners are probably not going to stop it. So if they do, I think just try and optimize it as much as they can.
Okay, so we've got, obviously, if we've got a myope, we need to correct their vision. So our optical treatments are ideal if we can get efficacy out of those. Low-dose atropine, obviously, we've got some problems we need to iron out, and we have to work with the evidence base we have at the moment. So do you think that, our clinician colleagues should chat to their compounding pharmacist and ask questions about, are you confident of the stability of the product? I guess if the pharmacist answers them back, we might not know what to do with that information.
Exactly.
If they can't answer that, what do we do? Do we just go 0.025 until we know better? Or what do you think is the best thing to do?
If you look at the recent LAMP2-year findings, kind of, you know, the 0.05% efficacy, if you like, in terms of axial length and refraction in LAMP is almost equivalent to the 0.01% efficacy data from the ATOM 2 study. So again, coming back to that, you know, if we're prescribing a slightly higher dose, are we actually providing that dose? Are we providing 0.01% or 0.05% of atropine or of its breakdown products? Is it tropic acid rather than atropine that we're giving? So it is a consideration to my mind, kind of, you know, I think kind of just having, I suppose, a really close look at what's happening to every individual patient in our practice.
Right.
The safety profile kind of that's happening, making sure, you know, everything is as we would want it and that the side effects are not kind of terrible. Taking a look at accommodation and taking a look at people's size and seeing if what we would expect to happen is happening.
So we don't want side effects, but if we have a bit of mydriasis, if we have a bit of cycloplegia, at least we know it's working.
Exactly.
At least we know we've got something being delivered to the eye.
It's getting into the eye and it's having some kind of biological effect in there.
That's a really interesting way to think of it as well. This is fascinating. I think I've learned so much about atropine and about what we hope to really learn from the research in the near future, and also what we hope to gain from industry, what the research will lead to in terms of the products that we're going to be able to use, both in terms of atropine and in terms of things like the centile growth charts and measurements of axial length. So thank you so much for your wisdom. That's been really interesting stuff.
And I haven't quite been called that before, wisdom, but anyway.
Oh, wisdom.
You're welcome.
Nerdy goodness, yes. Wisdom. I thought just to finish up, we'd sort of lighten it up a little bit, and I just for everyone to sort of get to know you a little bit beyond the nerdy goodness and the wisdom. Do you have a secret hidden talent?
Secret hidden talent. Oh,
you have a secret hidden talent.
I don't know whether you call it a talent or not. I've been known to throw a few shapes on a dance floor from time to time.
Oh, nice.
Not sure if you ever want to experience kind of endure that concept. I can make a dicky bow out of paper. That's kind of my secret hidden talent.
You can make a what out of paper?
A dicky bow, which is a form of bow tie. We call it a dicky bow.
That's
bow tie.
Impressive. That is impressive. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, that both of those things sound like a reasonable expectation for the next International Myopia Conference, paper ties and dance moves. And just as a bit of a nerd, sort of back to the nerdy element of things, what's your favorite ophthalmic word? I was thinking of this myself, and I was thinking, what words do I like saying? And I came up with epitheliopathy. I like that word.
Yeah.
It's fun to say. Yeah.
Yeah. I like Sinikie.
Yeah, it's a pretty good one.
The word. My favorite one, though, is probably Iris Bombay. Maybe that's just though because it reminds me of my favorite gin, but I don't know.
I thought of a curry. curry.
There you go. Maybe that shows the difference between
us. Nearly dinner time here in Australia. Fantastic. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, James. This has been a really fascinating chat. I'm sure it's been very thought-provoking for our listeners as well. There's definitely a lot that we still need to learn about atropine, and I think that this is, we want to make sure that clinicians, mm-hmm. that we have the best information to take action in practice, but also that we're keeping our options open for what could come to light in future. So I think that's the really valuable component of what we've talked about today.
Yeah, I think we just need a kind of just a short-term kind of wait-and-see approach. Kind of don't be too quick to go gung-ho taking it on, but also don't be too quick to dismiss it and see where the evidence leads us in time.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. And I think we've learned a lot from that. So thank you so much, James.
No, thank you. It's great work that you guys are doing with my open profile, and this now will add to it again. So kind of thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. More, it's all about the nerdy goodness, isn't it?
Yep, sure is.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, James.